This is an entirely different outlook from that of a British or French Foreign Office or Colonial Office official. But it's not very widely different from the spirit that created the dominions of Canada, South Africa, and Australia, and brought forward the three Home Rule Bills for Ireland. It's in the older and more characteristic English tradition from which the Declaration of Independence derives. It sets aside, without discussion, the detestable idea of subject people. Here we'll not enter into political complications attendant upon the making of the Panama Canal, for they introduce no fresh light upon this interesting question of the American method in world politics. The history of Panama is American history purely, but manifestly just as the internal political structure of the Union was a new thing in the world, so too were its relations with the world beyond its borders. 7th. We've been at some pains to examine the state of mind of Europe and of America in regard to international relations in the years that led up to the world tragedy of 1914, because as more and more people are coming to recognize, that great war, or some such war, was a necessary consequence of the mentality of the period. All the things that men and nations do are the outcome of instinctive motives reacting upon the ideas which talk and books and newspapers and schoolmasters and so forth have put into people's heads. Physical necessities, pestilences, changes of climate, and the like outer things may deflect and distort the growth of human history, but its living root is thought. All human history is fundamentally a history of ideas. Between the man of today and the Cro-Magnon, the physical and mental differences are very slight. Their essential difference lies in the extent and content of the mental background which we've acquired in the 500 or 600 generations that intervene. We're too close to the events of the Great War to pretend that this outline can record the verdict of history thereupon, but we may hazard the guess that when the passions of the conflict have faded, it will be Germany that will be most blamed for bringing it about. And she'll be blamed not because she was morally and intellectually very different from her neighbors, but because she had the common disease of imperialism in its most complete and energetic form. No self-respecting historian, however superficial and popular his aims may be, can countenance the legend produced by the stresses of the war that the German is a sort of human being more cruel and abominable than any other variety of men. All the great states of Europe before 1914 were in a condition of aggressive nationalism and drifting towards war. The government of Germany did but lead the general movement. She fell into the pit first, and she floundered deepest. She became the dreadful example at which all her fellow sinners could cry out. For long, Germany and Austria had been plotting an extension of German influence eastward through Asia Minor to the east. The German idea was crystallized in the phrase Berlin to Baghdad. Antagonized to the German dreams were those of Russia, which was scheming for an extension of the Slav ascendancy to Constantinople and through Serbia to the Adriatic. These lines of ambition lay across one another and were mutually incompatible. The feverish state of affairs in the Balkans was largely the outcome of the intrigues and propaganda sustained by the German and Slav schemes. Turkey turned for support to Germany, Serbia to Russia. Romania and Italy, both Latin in tradition, both nominally allies of Germany, pursued remoter and deeper schemes in common. Ferdinand, the Tsar of Bulgaria, was following still darker ends, and the squalid mysteries of the Greek court, whose king was the German Kaiser's brother-in-law, are beyond our present powers of inquiry. But the tangle didn't end with Germany on the one hand and Russia on the other. The greed of Germany in 1871 had made France her inveterate enemy. The French people, aware of their inability to recover their lost provinces by their own strength, had conceived exaggerated ideas of the power and helpfulness of Russia. The French people had subscribed enormously to Russian loans. France was the ally of Russia. If the German powers made war upon Russia, France would certainly attack them. Now, the short eastern French frontier was very strongly defended. There was little prospect of Germany repeating the successes of 1870-71 against that barrier. But the Belgian frontier of France was longer and less strongly defended. An attack in overwhelming force on France through Belgium might repeat 1870 on a larger scale. The French left might be swung back southeasterly on Verdun as a pivot and crowded back upon its right as one shuts an open razor. This scheme the German strategists had worked out with great care and elaboration. Its execution involved an outrage upon the law of nations because Prussia had undertaken to guarantee the neutrality of Belgium and had no quarrel with her, and it involved the risk of bringing in Great Britain, which power had also pledged to protect Belgium against Germany. Yet the Germans believed that their fleet had grown strong enough to make Great Britain hesitate to interfere, and with a view to possibilities, they had constructed a great system of strategic railways to the Belgian frontier and made every preparation for the execution of this scheme. So they might hope to strike down France at one blow and deal at their leisure with Russia. In 1914, all things seemed moving together in favor of the two Central Powers. Russia, it's true, had been recovering since 1906, but only very slowly. France was distracted by financial scandals. The astounding murder of Monsieur Calmette, the editor of the Figaro, by the wife of Monsieur Caillaux, the Minister of Finance, brought these to a climax in March. Britain, all Germany was assured, was on the verge of a civil war in Ireland. Repeated efforts were made, both by foreign and English people, to get some definite statement of what Britain would do if Germany and Austria assailed France and Russia. But the British Foreign Secretary maintained a front of heavy ambiguity up to the very day of the British entry into the war. As a consequence, there was a feeling on the continent that Britain would either not fight or delay fighting, and this may have encouraged Germany to go on threatening France. Events were precipitated on June the 28th by the assassination of the Archduke Francis Ferdinand, the heir to the Austrian Empire, when on a state visit to Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia. Here was a timely excuse to set the armies marching. "It's now or never," said the German emperor. Serbia was accused of instigating the murderers, and notwithstanding the fact that Austrian commissioners reported that there was no evidence to implicate the Serbian government, the Austro-Hungarian government contrived to press this grievance towards war. On July the 23rd, Austria discharged an ultimatum at Serbia, and in spite of a practical submission on the part of Serbia and of the efforts of Sir Edward Grey, the British Foreign Secretary, to call a conference of the powers, declared war against Serbia on July the 28th. Russia mobilized her army on July the 30th, and on August the 1st, Germany declared war upon her. German troops crossed into French territory next day, and simultaneously with the delivery of an ultimatum to the unfortunate Belgians, the big flanking movement through Luxembourg and Belgium began. Westward rode the scouts and advance guards. Westward rushed a multitude of automobiles packed with soldiers. Enormous columns of grey-clad infantry followed. Round-eyed, fair young Germans they were for the most part, law-abiding, educated youngsters who had never yet seen a shot fired in anger. This was war, they were told. They had to be bold and ruthless. Some of them did their best to carry out these militarist instructions at the expense of the ill-fated Belgians.